Right. Well, thank you all very much for being here. My name is Doug Judy. I'm the Executive Director of the Build Healthy Places Network, and I am a pediatrician and public health professor at UC Berkeley, so I'm really coming from where you're sitting, and it's been my great pleasure over the last 5-6 years to really get to know everybody who's here in the front row and the work that they're doing, and gradually come to understand the financing and the investment and the fact that their goals are really identical. So I really want to thank our speakers today for joining us. I also have interesting cutting-edge news. So some of you, how many of you were able to participate or heard about the reception we had at the Chicago Fed last night? Were there some there? So we submitted a policy statement to the APHA specifically titled Opportunities for Health Collaboration, Leveraging Community Development Investments to Improve Health in Low-Income Neighborhoods. And we just found out that it passed. So it's been approved. So the APHA will now have a statement, a policy statement, specifically providing some guidance to public health, population health practitioners and professionals about how we should be interacting with the speakers we just heard. So it's pretty exciting. So let me, I'll try to skip through a few things that the others managed to cover quite well. So our network, you can see our vision statement here. We're funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and created to really continue the work that we had started with the Federal Reserve Bank System that really, they're one of the regulators you heard about, help the banks invest in the Community Reinvestment Act, and we're really increasingly wanting to see deeper impact than what historically had just been housing. At the network, we focus on connecting audiences, on providing access to resources, to helping identify health-related value, and focusing on measurement. And I'll talk a little bit of that at the end. So I want to quickly talk about scope and scale. You've seen some examples. I want to sort of zip through a broader sense from my perspective as a medical person. Some new changes and some new funding innovations, and we've actually heard some of those, so I can skip through that quickly, and some new advances in measurement. So we've heard that your zip code is more important than your genetic code, and a colleague of mine at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco likes to say that community development is in the zip code improvement business. It's an easy way of thinking about how we really work together, and I think it's fascinating that for so long a lot of us were unaware that there were zip code improvers. We were busy identifying zip-coded place as being bad for you, but didn't really fully realize the scope of the investments going on. So community development now is not what this picture is. This is Pruitt-Igoe. It was one of the early 1950s, one of the early government HUD-supported community development, sort of urban renewal, right? That was the old term that's not used anymore. It only lasted 16 years before it went from being a premier example of community investment to being a desolate ghetto and was demolished. Many people actually say the end of modernism occurred when that dynamite went off and knocked that place down. Because it's really important to remember that those projects replaced, this was 100 acres of dilapidated Victorians and old homes and apartment buildings that were torn down. And this was the guy who designed this, the same one that designed the World Trade Centers. Top-notch architect. You can see there's a bus, there's a school, there's a church, there's playgrounds. It seemed like a great idea. Didn't work. So now, you may have heard this, around $200 billion a year is being invested through community development explicitly into low-income neighborhoods and very much addressing the exact same things we're considering. So you've heard some of these. So this is, they focus on housing. So in San Diego, you see there's solar panels on the roof. Those low-income families receive a check from the utility company every month. On the right is supportive housing for the homeless. I actually have walked by there. Any of us would want to move in. Youth development, got a charter school. On the right is in Houston, that's there's a daycare center and early learning facility as part of a community center. Economic development, so again, the one on the left is in Houston as well. That's the poorest community in the Houston area, and yet that's their new town center. And on the right is Market Creek Plaza. The community residents there mostly come from southern Mexico, and they really wanted to have it represent that, so they went for sort of a theme around like the Palenque Mayan theme. But a little bit larger scale, this is one that's random ones that just came across my desk the other day. So Low-Income Investment Fund is based in San Francisco. It's a national CDFI. So this is Downtown Crossing. This is a Sears and Roebuck distribution center. It's been sitting empty for 20 years in downtown Memphis. It's now, so Lyft I listed because they were one of the partners. There were many, but they provided $10 million of the $56 million in New Markets tax credits. It's a $200 million investment to turn this empty building for 20 years into a whole community. So within this, there's a charter high school for arts and sciences, a teacher residency and graduate urban education plan, a program, 2,500 students a year are going to be served. There's a wellness and fitness center, art exhibition and art making facilities, a healthcare clinic, a comprehensive cancer treatment center and medical offices, going to serve 125,000 people a year, 262 units of affordable housing in there as well, and it's expected to create 900 permanent jobs. Like, it's mind-blowing, right? This is a very disinvested part of a very disinvested city, and this is all being built right now. The one point I want to make, though, is that I can guarantee, after having worked with community development professionals for a while, all those awesome things that I just listed are there because a deal could be closed on them. It wasn't up front necessarily thinking about what ought to be here. There was a sense that there was an empty building and it should be something good should be done with it. But those things are there because the deals were there. So one of the real roles I believe that public health can play is what else ought to be there. For example, I think a daycare center or an early childhood center would be a perfect addition if we were able to weigh in and say these are the types of resources that ought to. Maybe something could be changed, or there could be a real push to get philanthropy to raise the money for that last piece. So it's just something to think about. And again, $200 million that already is clearly going to have positive health effects, but that we could help, and they're interested in doing it as well as possible. They want the $200 million to have the greatest impact as well. To move up a scale, this is Sunnydale, the largest public housing project in San Francisco, 50 acres of San Francisco real estate. 1,500 people live there. It's the most dangerous, drug-infested, sickest, literally unhealthiest population in the city. Former barracks. So Mercy Housing, one of the national affordable housing developers, is won a contract to redevelop it on the order of $800 million, 50 acres. The related companies, interestingly, is a for-profit development company. They're actually they're the ones doing Hudson Yards in New York City. So they're partners. So I will zoom in a little bit. So this is old Army barracks, disconnected from the whole community. Taxis won't even go there. This is what they're going to do. So it's going to build townhomes. They're going to double the number of units, so the number of affordable units remains the same, and there's going to be mixed-income units. In the lower right corner, they're going to have a community hub. That's going to face out to the existing neighborhood and have a YMCA, a bank branch, a small grocery store, all of these types of services. But again, a lot of this, having talked to the folks who were putting it together, was based on hunch and intuition and a general idea that these are the right things to do. And I think there's ways that we can leverage these opportunities to learn ourselves as public health professionals and also help guide. But I also want to be clear that these are not all just in plans, right? So this is one that really exists. So this is Eastlake in Atlanta. This is Purpose Built Communities, which is an organization all of you should get to know because they're doing some of the best holistic community redevelopment in the country. So this is what it used to look like. It was known as Little Vietnam because it was a war zone, not because anyone there was Vietnamese. The violent crime was so high that on average, every family was experienced a violent crime every year. They had a 5% at grade level reading scores and 13% employment. So purpose-built communities, they're one of the early examples of this community quarterback, which is actually the term they use now. And they focused on doing three things simultaneously, which is what's so hard. Mixed-income housing, cradle-to-career education, and community wellness. And I'll add that when I first met them, that community wellness circle said public safety. Why? Because when I said, what you're doing is health, they said, no, we're not doing health. We don't want to deal with a clinic. And I said, no, really, this is all health. And so they really realized that public safety falls under that. And so there's a real hesitation or misunderstanding of what health is and what medical care is. So this is the housing now. So now, they doubled the number of units. Employment is up to 70% among employable adults. This is in the middle of that former slum. And the reading rates, violent crime dropped by 90%. And actually, the president, Carol Naughton, has been working with them for the past 15 years. And this, like I say, happened around 10 to 15 years. It's been happening. One thing she noted is that obesity completely disappeared. There are no heavy children in the neighborhood anymore. And 15 years ago, it was an early sight of the type of obesity epidemic. They never had any intervention focused on obesity. It's sort of, you know, you can kind of imagine when you live in a place that looks like this, it kind of takes care of itself. This is their new high school. It looks like a spaceship landed. They have 95 to 98% at grade level reading. They outperform the wealthiest neighborhoods of Atlanta now, and it's still 60 to 80% free and reduced lunches. This is a real place. So to move on to funding innovations, we actually already heard about the Healthy Foods Financing Initiative, so I can skip that. You know, it provides ways of getting farmers markets and grocery stores, corner stores in. The number I had was a little bit lower, but it's now in the over 150 million plus. The Healthy Futures Fund, you heard, is focused on clinics in low-income communities, specifically who have identified the neighborhood as their patient, and linking it to housing. And we're going to be moving into the second 100 million, so $200 million there. And the interesting thing about that is that the partnership, and think about this for a second, it's Kresge Foundation, that's based in Detroit, that's the Kmart Foundation, basically. Kresge Foundation, LISC, which is a CDFI, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Morgan Stanley. Kind of an unexpected bedfellows, right? The Healthy Neighborhoods Equity Fund, I want to mention. So they're based in Boston, and I just will read you what I pulled off the web. HNEF invests in neighborhoods that are in the early to mid stages of transformational change, where investment can help catalyze and accelerate that change. They're identifying pre-gentrification, likely gentrification places in the Boston area, and investing in them early. And what's fascinating about it is the investors are going to get their money back 10 years later, plus the gain in value of the property, but the developers have the money up front. So they can buy the property and save it for affordable housing. So it's actually harnessing the what's often seen as a negative around gentrification. It will be able to protect a lot of the housing in these places. It's a fascinating idea, and it is not philanthropy, and it's not government. It's really private sector, although Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was an early investor, which is key. Don mentioned earlier the need to get this ground-level investment to allow the rest of the investments to happen, and this was a really good example of that. We heard a little bit about hospital partnerships. Ones that I know of, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is investing directly into building a community center, clinic, library combination. Again, these are unusual that hospitals are not just, they're directly investing to build homes. Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, same thing. And I wanted to mention Vita Stanford. I actually got a chance, these are my photos. I had a chance to visit the site, and the hospital swapped land with a public housing project, the Housing Authority, in order to build a new tower. In fact, you can see behind the farm on the bottom, that's the new hospital tower. So then they handed over parking lots that they owned to the Housing Authority, so the Housing Authority could build new townhomes, which is what you see. This is public housing. The families could move in there, not a single home was lost, and they doubled the number because they could do townhomes. And so now you have this lovely farm in the middle, they've got businesses. It's really, it blows your mind when you see these types of investments. So I'll end with just a mention of measurement. So our website, through the buildhealthyplaces.org, has a new portal called Measure Up. And what we're trying to do is pull together the measurement activities that are happening in the community development sector and make them as accessible as possible. So we've got this, you know, what do we talk about when we talk about measurement? Like, what does that even mean to talk about measurement? What is data? We have a series of different categories. We've tried to make it very understandable and accessible by people with different levels of background. We provide featured resources that you can dive into, and I want to mention just a couple of them for this audience. So one is the Metrics for Healthy Communities. This was developed, that we developed in partnership with the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis and Wilder Research, and they're using this idea of logic models to help community development professionals really think through what do they have, what are their outputs, and how are outputs different than outcomes, and what are short, middle, and long-term outcomes that might be coming from health. And you can see on the bottom left, that's a series of the different logic models that they have within the system. And what's really important, and I thought was why I was excited about this project, within the full logic models that you can click on, data outcomes that have data that's available, we have live links that go directly to the national data sources. So some are county level, metro level, state level, sometimes even census tract level. Stewards, who's ever heard of Stewards of Affordable Housing for the Future? Right? This is the 11 largest nonprofit affordable housing developers in the country. They're a consortium. This, believe it or not, they have a two-page, and I put this up just so you can see, I've got the other half of the other page. They are now testing in 30 different sites the ability to gather on a regular basis. They're trying to assess impact. They haven't figured out how to monetize the impact yet, but they want to see whether it can be done. So you can see the priority areas, the outcome measures, you can see some of the examples, and where they're going to get the data. So work, income assets, youth education, housing stability, community engagement, health and wellness. Like, how public health does that sound, right? And these are housing authorities. These are housing developers who are gathering this. So we're going to be able to soon have troves of data that they're gathering that I would like everyone here to follow up with, and we can dig them up. Yeah, thank you. And last, the social impact calculator. So this is the low-income investment fund that I mentioned earlier. Nancy Andrews, who's the CEO, just got tired, basically, of all the chatter about there being value to the types of investment they're doing, and said, let's just see if we can figure it out. So she had a MIT grad, just had him dig into the public health literature, and what's great about this site, if you go into it, you can actually put real numbers in, and real numbers pop out. And down at the bottom, you can sort of see, it's small there, but it says methodology, and those are the actual research articles that they base these numbers on. And these are some examples they have on their sites. So for one high school diploma, it can equal $500,000 more in increased income over her lifespan. So someone who is investing in schools and has a wild guess of the number of kids they have and whether the graduation rate has gone up a bit as a result of their investment can begin to make some idea of their investment being more than just in the building itself. So with that, I'll finish. My sort of closing bullets to take home is how, you know, in terms of connecting public health and community development, first, you've heard this vividly here today. We have partners. They are excited about this work. They have expertise and they have resources, which are different than ours and in many ways supplement what we do. The ability to leverage their investments, these are already happening, whether or not we're there, and there's a great opportunity to help guide what they're doing and suggest other ways to perhaps make them even more effective. And last, there's really research opportunities. The ability for us to begin to figure out how do we measure health return on investment, and how do we actually, if these different investments are all going on, can we learn something there that helps us figure out which ones have the greatest impact, which is a part of our own research literature. And we certainly can't get $800 million grants from the NIH to do this on ourselves. So these make for great partners. And I'll finish, maybe I'll just leave this up. These are some resources that you can use. The Partners in Progress is one that is investing in community quarterbacks. And the What Works and What Counts books came out of the Fed and are both free, downloadable, and you can also even order hard copies. And thank you very much.
How many of you would like us to put these slides that had resources on it on a website so that you get it? Okay.
We do that.
We can do that. And how many of you would be interested in a webinar that had some of these folks go through some of this where you could have some of your colleagues join you? Okay. We can do that too. We have very little time left for questions, and so I'd like to ask my panel to please come up quickly, and we'll take at the middle microphone, if you could go to the mic, and please, because of the limited time, say your name and quickly state your question for the panelists. Go ahead. Yep, it's on.
Hi, I'm Susan Mojica from Boulder County Public Health. And my question for has to do with the redevelopment and public housing communities. And you were mentioning, even with the success story, very impressive, by the way, how many kids were still on free and reduced lunch, education initiatives, and employment. Can you kind of track or give us a nationwide view of how much education leading to community college with certificates and a career path and employment security are becoming part of this very progressive community development focus?
Hmm. That's a good question. I don't have a direct answer to that. I would say the industry has so rapidly embraced the importance of education and jobs as part of their work. I mean, really, the way I say it is that the community development sector has rapidly realized that looking at the well-being of the people is as or more important than the buildings that they've been building. And meanwhile, in public health, we've been realizing the place is really important, which is why these two come together. I don't know if you guys have a specific sense of how that's moving.
Is it on?
Yeah.
So I don't have any stats per se, but I can corroborate with Doug's point that I think across the entire community development field and sort of within the DD5 and stuff like that, all of us are pushing really hard to be as comprehensive as we can be and how we can relate to our communities. So on Charter School Point, for example, which is now a national network of charter schools in DD5 to have large portfolios of charter schools, where they're trying to work with their borrowers to track those kinds of improvements and performance and follow through on student diversity, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an enormous amount of efforts that come out of that network, as an example. Many of us are turning our attention towards, are we investing in businesses and nonprofits and other enterprises that are creating net new jobs for people that are hard to employ, and we're trying to get our arms around how to track that and how to get data from our customers. So there's a much higher level of awareness around those types of issues, and everyone's working and changing and learning at the same time. So it's a really interesting period for all of us.
Yeah, actually, why don't I'd add that, interestingly, I think the community development sector has fully recognized the importance of education and jobs. What they didn't fully understand, from my experience, is that those are the same as health. That if you have access to good education and good jobs, you end up and your parents end up healthier. And that's the link that was less obvious, I'd say. Thank you.
I'm Matthew Wayne, County, Michigan. My question is basically to those on the community development side, maybe. And earlier this year, I convinced the county to give a bit of a community development, so it is now under public health. Mm-hmm. Whether the county says that we want to spend it in community development, but we were surprised that most of the communities are pushing back because they see it as the county taking over. So is there a strategy where you can sell them the decision? I know.
Maybe you have the answer, Don.
So, you're looking at this as something that looks like collective impact, right? Bringing people together in various groups that have interests. Often, you have scale, which should be incredibly helpful to you in terms of leveraging better things than can be done by individual communities that have to create very, very complex deals in little tiny pieces. And you have the opportunity to bring people together, figure out what priorities to have, and then do them at a larger scale than they've done before, which I would think would be a powerful magnet to bring people in. That is, we're going to do something, be part of it, as opposed to lament that, you know, you're no longer going to have resources. Just move forward.
I think one of the most important things to do is to own whatever the history and legacy of the department is in a community. How we can really progress around community outreach workers and other ways that we actually involve the community, both as employees, volunteers, and law partners. And it takes a long time to actually build the kind of trust that you need for people to then accept you as playing a role and not see you as a occupying.
Yeah, Mary just said to me that identifying a community champion is the way to go, and I was like Alice, for example. But yes, I don't think it's an easy answer.
We spend a lot of time before we even go any kind of going into a new market or a new area. We really spend a lot of time to assess who are the other stakeholders there and try to see, you know, can we unify and start to speak in the same language and realize that coming together shoulder to shoulder, we can accomplish a lot more. And so I would agree that you really have to kind of do the grassroots to embed yourself and show people how you're transformative and not threatened.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Marjorie Schaff from Healthy Medicine Policy here in Chicago. So first I want to say thank you for the panel. Thank you all for the role and gave me
also I was just chatting with Don on the sideline because I think Doug was wrapping up this presentation and asking a question about the equity fund in Boston and whether or not Robert Wood Johnson provided a letter of permanent capital, and he said no, we provided some credit and spent it. I thought that's exactly the kind of additional support that CFI's need for to take the next out. We'll go out as far on the risk spectrum as we think we can and still stand a reasonable chance in getting our investors' capital back. But being networked in with bodies like yourselves is what will get us to reinvent ourselves a little bit to be more effective. Does that help you?
Just one thing to say is that in some places, CDFIs have many more opportunities than they have resources to spend. In other places, the creating the deals, it takes 4 years to really competent people. And if the city or the county or the hospital has competent people to create the deal, they can lead the way because they're financing institutions that are looking for good deals. So as health partners, if we want to move this forward, one thing we can do is leverage the expertise of our partners in creating the opportunity, figuring out how to put together the property, figuring out how to put together the different pieces of capital with partners in order to create something that changes the community. We have huge opportunities.
And one thing that we're finding out now is we're actually trying to undergo that process of really creating specific linkages where we can provide housing for the healthcare providers that know that housing them with us will keep them healthier at a fraction of the cost. What we're finding out now is because of the complexities of the tax credit program, unit subsidies under traditional sources, we don't have the ability to say, you want it in real time, don't you? Right? We can't deliver it in real time, even if it's a vacant unit existing right now. So we really have to work at ways to come up with combining the dollars to create the facility and then to support its operation and really have it set up to meet these needs and specifically your institution's needs and not try to drive it because it's literally a square peg and we're not able to try to do it under the way we currently are structured.
Thanks so much.
Great, thank you.
I grew up in one of those neighborhoods you brought up on the map there in Manhattan, but now I'm in Florida. And I was very interested in all those services you were talking about that you brought into the community. But I didn't hear anything about technology, so I was wondering if in any way residents are being equipped with technology or access to technology.
Yes, it's very critical. I mean, all our properties have computer labs. Computer literacy is critical on a number of fronts. I mean, we use it to access, obviously, class and other content that's beneficial to the residents, but it's also their vehicle to look for jobs, apply for jobs. We're finding that in a lot of communities which previously have been in food deserts, now are not, but they're in financial services deserts. And so if you don't know how to create a checking account and manage it through one of these, you're not being helped. And so yes, technology is very important.
Where we'd like to be in the future, just not where we are right now. And so, as our nation has moved towards Common Core, teaching young people how to think, not content, there is also this movement towards blended learning, which means that you use technology in all of the different ways to individualize learning for young people. And so that's another really important way to not be just a computer lab, although that's really important in the digital divide world. But that we actually are teaching young people to use technology really differently in all parts of their lives. And so there's an emergence around the country of these hackathons and other ways that you get these young people involved in thinking about the creation of applications and innovation, because that actually gets to position them to be entrepreneurs and drivers of an economy as opposed to just consumers.
Great, thank you.
From my perspective, I've been working in health and law policy and social determinants of health for almost a decade, and I'm absolutely thrilled to see everybody else talk about it too. But one of the things that I feel like we're still really challenged with, as Doug mentioned, is the idea of the return on investment. We know what works, we know how to show people to do it, but I feel like we're having a very hard time explaining what are the really measurable results that can assure a funder that we're on that logic model, that pathway to good health outcomes, but that we can see within a project delivery period, that we don't have to wait for 20 years for good health outcomes to materialize. And so I'd love to hear more thoughts about kind of what matters in terms of measuring success.
I agree with you that we're under the gun with a lot of good reasons to produce data and to show impacts, and again, it's not waiting 20 years, it's right now. So I would say that right now, I think we find the most, from an aggregate value of the impact perspective, really looking at the consumption of healthcare, particularly with our permanent sports housing providers, our permanent sports housing residents, because we know that prior to joining us, they either got none or they did it through the emergency room. So we're getting a lot sharper about intake interviews and specifically asking that question. What's been your past year in terms of hospitalizations, emergency room visits? And then we track them at every lease renewal to see where they're at, because obviously that's improving. That's an easily quantifiable impact.
The other thing, and part of the morning is health impact assessment panels. And if you look at the kinds of calculations and estimates that people are doing in decision making, health impact assessment often provides an estimate of what we think the benefit is going to be in dollars, as well as health outcomes. If you can then compare at various points along the way how well the project is achieving potential outcomes, you have not only a goal that's monetary, but you show that you're performing on goals. And there's not much that's a stronger way to present information than that for investors who want to see just that kind of performance.
Okay, one last question, and then Carlene's throwing us out of here.
My name is Katie Byerly, and I'm a PhD student at UNC Chapel Hill. My question is also related to evaluation. I'm curious about how Robert the drivers that they outline on these very low-carb foods, and curious if they'll be aligning with the Building Healthy Places Network, and if that's something that maybe in the future will look like the county health rankings, providing a more robust set of measures that we can use that are more cross-cutting between public health and the better partners.
So I would encourage you to either go to one of the sessions for researchers at the booth, or sign on to one of the webinars to go deeper than I can go right here. Let me say that the framework is intended to give us a vision around the culture of health, which is a long-term generation health goal. And what we're trying to do is give people part of that vision by describing what are the elements and the ways that we might even conceive or think about. We will measure those particular variables, but the idea of measuring isn't that we're going to grant them to the specific variables, but rather if we invest as a country in something that looks like a cross-population, deep culture of health, all of those things should get better.
Thank you. I want to thank the panel for really an extraordinary session, for all of you for staying an extra half hour to have time for some questions. We've made a commitment that we'll post some of the resources, we'll put a webinar together. I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for their broad vision and their willingness to invest in this work and to allow us to share it with all of you. So I want to thank the panel.